We've seen that Sholem Aleichem pulls no punches in presenting through each daughter the pressing challenge of the day. Huddle's choice removes her from the Jewish people through the revolutionary movement, and Chava's choice removes her from the Jews through intermarriage, which at the time required conversion to Christianity.
Ruth, in this lecture, we're going to study the figure of Chava, Tevye and Golda's relationship to their daughter, Chava. What are some of the things that we're going to learn?
Well, Chava is obviously the most dramatic of all the stories, and that's one of the reasons that when Sholem Aleichem himself created a play based on these stories, he used the Chava episode as its centerpiece, and that's why all other productions have done exactly the same thing. Chava is most dramatic because the conflict becomes most acute. This is the first time that we see that Tevye is living in an environment which is increasingly unfriendly to him. This was a time when pogroms had been raging against the Jews, when the Tsarist government was itself trying to deflect attention from attacks upon itself by encouraging attacks against the Jews. And it was when the Jews felt that their stay in Russia was becoming much more insecure. That this is the moment when Chava is written by Sholem Aleichem to express some of that. And so it begins with Tevye saying that, you know, he's lived very happily in this place for many years, but his relations with the priest are increasingly difficult, and that is because when he gets into a conversation with the priest, it's not that he wants to be buddy-buddy with him, but it's your God and my God. In other words, it's contentious. And no matter what Tevye says and how cleverly he may say it, the priest laughs. The priest smiles. And Tevye says, at the time I didn't know what the priest was smiling or laughing at, but as time went on, I understood. And then we hear from him the story of this daughter who falls in love with a Ukrainian young man who is the scribe of the town, kind of the secretary, town secretary, a very erudite young person. And they have all kinds of intellectual interests in common. But then the question comes, what happens at the point that they want to marry? And
this young man is not Jewish.
No, of course, I'm sorry. I should have made that more explicit, that he is a Ukrainian Christian. And the only way that they can be married in a place where there were no civil marriages is for her to convert to Christianity, so that it is not just a question of them falling in love and getting married. But in order to do so, she would have to be baptized and she would have to enter the church. And this is the point at which Tevye is confronted with something that is difficult for him to face. He is used to being lenient. He is used to listening to his daughters and giving in as much as he possibly can. And here is the point at which this would destroy something very precious of his.
So just connecting backwards to the earlier stories, there's Seitel, Huddel, and now we meet Chava. How do you see the stories relating to each other, one after the other?
We have to come back to the fact that Tevye is being written by Sholem Aleichem with no master plan. It's just that every time Sholem Aleichem has a certain subject that he wants to deal with, he comes back to Tevye, and now that he has these daughters, he builds these episodes around these daughters. And so they do tend to be sequential. And what is so interesting is that they are variations on a theme. They all seem to develop in the same way. There is a matchmaker, or the possibility of a match, or the necessity of a match for a young marriageable girl. And then who might be the proper person for her to marry from Tevye's point of view. And then whom does she choose? And so the element of free choice, of marry whom you love, of romantic or erotic attraction being the key to choice for the younger generation, is always in conflict with what is needed by Tevye as a member of the older generation representing the Jewish tradition and the idea of Jewish continuity. Our subject today is the chapter of Chava, and the idea that Sholem Aleichem had created a quasi-Jewish territory is borne out by the realization that until this point, we have come up against almost no Gentiles in these stories. In the earlier stories of Mendel and Moicher Svorim, whom Sholem Aleichem called the grandfather, the Zayde of modern Yiddish literature, Jews had to resort to a peasant, to an intermediary, every time they wanted to get from one place to another. And along the same lines, in some of Sholem Aleichem's other stories, his Jewish character has to rely on a non-Jewish ferryman when he wants to cross the river, on a non-Jewish coachman when he wants to travel on land, and on non-Jews when taking the train, because Jews were not given such public employment. But since Tevye is man enough, and in this sense corrective enough, and competent enough to navigate the territory, he has not had to rely on others. And to be sure, Menachem Mendel in Yehupetz is trying to evade the Tsarist police, and Perchik has been exiled by the Tsarist authorities. But that part of the non-Jewish background doesn't make its way into the stories until this episode of Chava, written 2 years after Hodl. We are scarcely aware that this quasi-Jewish territory actually exists on sufferance in a Christian-governed and increasingly hostile Gentile land. So here with a vengeance, Tevye is made aware of the Ukrainian Christian surroundings, and he begins to experience himself less securely. The intramural challenges that he's been confronting from his fellow Jews and family members are now supplemented by incursions from the outside. So he says, "You can take the best of horses. What will it amount to if it's kept in a stable all day long? And it's the same with good-looking daughters if you raise them among peasants in a hole like this, where there's not a living soul to talk to apart from the village elder, Anton Paparillo, the village scribe, Chvedka Galagan, and the village priest, damn his soul, whose name I can't even stand to mention. And not because I'm a Jew and he's a priest either. On the contrary, we've known each other for ages. I don't mean that we ever slapped each other's backs or danced at each other's weddings, but we said hello whenever we met and stopped to chat a bit about the latest news." And so the general description that we get here is of a man who gets along fairly well with his neighbors until something happens to draw attention to their differences. With the priest, he tries to limit conversation because the priest's job is to try to convert Jews to his religion. And if these men talk for too long, it generates into your God, my God. And then Tevye tells us that even if he comes up with a winning argument, the priest just laughs in his face. I tell you, there's nothing more aggravating than being laughed at by someone you've just finished throwing the book at. The hotter under the collar I'd get, the more he'd stand there and grin at me. Well, if I didn't understand what he thought was funny then, I'm sorry to say, I do now. So this is the first time that Tevye reports on a power structure that puts him at a fundamental disadvantage. Tevye relies on his powers of speech. Even with God, he speaks with the assurance that maybe he can persuade his listener. In all his other interactions, speech is his element. Speech is where he shines. Remember, you must know the game of rock, paper, scissors, in which everything depends on your hand. Rock, paper, scissors. So rock crushes scissors cuts paper, and paper covers rock, rock being power. So Tevye is in a game where the priest has rock and paper on his side, the power of the Tsar and the law of the land. Tevye can be cleverly cutting, and he is usually able to get the last word, but he can always be defeated in this game. The priest laughs indulgently. He can afford to let Tevye have his little fun and his little verbal victories, knowing that he is always going to have the upper hand. And more serious than the threat of the priest or the punitive regime is the infectious spirit of love and universal brotherhood. We have seen the spirit of love before. Now we see it expanded into this idea of universal love. Just as Perchik seduces Hoddle with the ideal of a classless society, so Chvedka invites Chava into a union that transcends their differences. When the two fall in love, it's not Chvedka the suitor who comes to make his case to Tevye, but the daughter who does it on her own. She doesn't champion Christianity over Judaism as the priest does. She speaks in the name of ecumenicism. To the extent that Tevye's storytelling represents the Jewish imperative, his discussion with Chava is the cornerstone of the entire work. This is a do-or-die moment in the Jews' struggle to preserve their integrity in the modern, non-denominational, universal, and universalist world. It's therefore something of a shock to realize how thoroughly Chava squelches her father's argument. God, says my Chava, created us all equal. So he did, I say. He created man in his likeness. But you had better remember that not every likeness is alike. Ish kematnas yodoi, as the Bible says. It's beyond belief, she says. How you have a verse from the Bible for everything. Maybe you also have one that explains why human beings have to be divided into Jews and Christians, masters and slaves, beggars and millionaires. Why, bless my soul, I say, if you don't seem to think, my daughter, that the millennium has arrived. And I tried explaining to her that the way things are now is the way they've been since day one. But why are they that way, she asks. Because that's how God made them, I say. Well, why did he make them like that? God gave us brains so that we should use them, says Chava, and she certainly makes good use of hers to out-debate her father so badly that he finally has to resort to a muddled combination of threat and insult. He is saved by the intervention of Golda, who gets the better of him as well. He tries to pull rank on his wife in his usual way by showing off his intellectual credentials. Here we are talking about the universe, and all you can think of is your borscht, he says to her. And she answers, better my borscht without the universe than the universe without my borscht. Had Chava known enough to challenge his Bible quotation, she could have scored more points, because the quotation that he uses against her, ish kematnas yodoi, means that every man should bring a gift according to his ability. Originally applied to Jews bringing their offerings to the temple, it offers no insight into Chava's question about why Jews should maintain their separateness as a people, except to affirm that they should. All in all, Tevye can come up with no reason at all for why Jews should maintain their distinctiveness, except that it is ordained and that intermarriage is prohibited. The interaction with Chava brings certain things into focus that we may not have realized sooner. Wonderful as it is to have had and to have Tevye as our spokesman, he cannot make the intellectual case for Judaism. He shows how the Jew functions in history, but he does not explain why. And the same might be said for the author, Sholem Aleichem, who offers very little of the kind of Jewish experience that is usually trotted out when writers want to show off Judaism and Jewishness at its best. Look, there are no scenes of the wonderful Sabbath, of candle lighting or kiddush, no engagement or wedding celebrations, of the kind that appear in Fiddler on the Roof, for example. There are no rabbis No Jewish scholars, only a butcher and a matchmaker who are hardly advertisements for the grandeur of Judaism. The holidays of Shavuot and Sukkot appear only in their agricultural function as seasonal festivals, when we see Tevye resting on his stoop rather than attending the synagogue. Once Chava starts asking Judaism to justify its existence and to do it in the language of contemporary polemics, Tevye is out of his element. By contrast, I would say, the case for non-denominational intermarriage is strong on several counts, including the force of Chava's unanswered argument. The ideological universalist cannot accept that a people should remain separate in the future just because it has done so in the past. Chava's impatience with Tevye's quotations shows her disdain for the authority of those quotations. Everything that Shalom Aleichem and his readers presumably appreciate of Tevye's wit is lost on Chava, who doesn't know enough to have any idea how skillfully her father is playing his intertextual instrument. From her perspective, a universalizing religion like Christianity has the advantage of cutting across ethnic boundaries by wanting the whole world to unite as one, albeit under its umbrella. She feels she's on the way to a society with no outdated distinctions. Judaism's tribal religion offends modernity. It offends modernity on both religious and national grounds. When Chava refers to Chvedka as a second Gorky, she stacks the deck even further against her father. The warmth with which Chava speaks of this rare, dear soul conveys the author Shalom Aleichem's personal affection and respect for Maxim Gorky, one of Russia's most famous writers, a socialist who opposed the Tsar's policy of one Russian nation under one leader and one religion. Gorky was known as a philo-Semite who spoke up for the Jews. After the pogroms of 1903 and 1905, Shalom Aleichem had joined forces with Gorky to put out an anthology of Yiddish literature in Russian translation. So if Chvedka is presented to us as a second Gorky, this meant that he was already sympathetic to the Jews, definitely a good guy, even a possible ally against the anti-Semitism that was then spreading. So in our story, Chvedka is the good Gentile who stands against the domineering priest. We've seen that Shalom Aleichem pulls no punches in presenting through each daughter the pressing challenge of the day. Hodel's choice removes her from the Jewish people through the revolutionary movement, and Chava's choice removes her from the Jews through intermarriage, which at the time required conversion to Christianity. But as far as Chava is concerned, conversion is just a formality to unite her with a wonderful man. Now, Fiddler on the Roof wants to make this much more explicit, and it goes much further. So it shows Fiedka, who is Chvedka, stepping in to save Chava from a bunch of hooligans, making it quite clear what we ought to think of this arrangement. You see, he equates Chava's opposition to romance with a Christian. He doesn't say Christian. He says, why? Because I'm not Jewish. He equates her opposition to romance with him as equal to the young Ukrainian's harassment of the Jew. Right? So what the filmmakers do quite explicitly is to put Jews on the defensive for wanting to maintain their separateness. And that is the theme of A Fiddler on the Roof, made very explicit in this scene and made very explicit at the end. In the American imagination, what could possibly be wrong with a Jew marrying someone of another faith or someone of another ethnicity? People do it all the time. So the people who wrote the script for the Fiddler on the Roof thought nothing of intermarriage. As a matter of fact, when they were asked about it, Sheldon Harnick, who wrote this, said, well, I'm intermarried. And so he couldn't see anything wrong with that. Now, from the point of view of Fiddler on the Roof, this is not a tragedy at all. So when it comes to the end of their production, and everybody has to leave this place because they are being driven away by a Tsarist decree, when this happens, you see, it's not any longer a problem. Chvedka and Chava both come together and they say, well, we don't want to stay here any longer in a land that you have to leave. So we are leaving too, and they leave together, and everything is fine. And you see what a wonderful person Chvedka is, that he is leaving together with Chava, and that they will not stay in the land of the evil Tsarist empire. But we are back now with Shalom Aleichem's text, and something goes unsaid in the story that would have been explicit to Shalom Aleichem's readers, because of course intermarriage in Tsarist Russia required Jewish conversion to Christianity and could not happen the other way around. So Chava's principled advocacy of a non-denominational universe does not acknowledge that she had to study catechism with the priest and be baptized before her marriage. Her argument is therefore a little disingenuous. Tevye experiences her marriage to Chvedka as the priest's ultimate triumph over him. And of course, that's how the priest experiences and why he gloats, knowing that Tevye's cleverness can do nothing to change the situation. Sorry, Tevye, your daughter is now ours. She belongs to me. That's how Jewish and Christian communities experienced intermarriage when that was clear. That is why Tevye confesses to Shalom Aleichem, the shame is even worse than the sorrow. As bad as the heartache, the disgrace is far worse. This episode disorients Tevye, unlike no other so far, and it greatly upset readers. How could you, Shalom Aleichem, let this happen? And if I may, let me just say that this is something I know from my mother, who was born in Tsarist-ruled Lithuania the year this story was published. My mother was a modern woman who spoke fluent Russian, Polish, French, and of course Yiddish, some Hebrew, German, and finally English. She got along famously with non-Jews, never spoke against any group, not against Russians, not against Poles, not even against Germans. The only people she would not tolerate were Jewish converts. As I was very surprised to learn when I once brought to our family Seder a fellow graduate student who had converted to Christianity, but told me how she missed being with her Jewish family at Passover. So she came to our Seder, and I later passed on to my mother this woman's thanks and mentioned how much it had meant to her as a convert. I hadn't mentioned that she was a convert because I didn't think it mattered. But my mother never forgave me. She used the word betrayal. Du hast mich verraten. You betrayed me. So if that's how she felt about my having issued to a convert a one-time invitation to our home, imagine Tevye's reaction to his daughter's conversion to Christianity at a time when anti-Semitism was fueling violence against the Jews. So Chava is unquestionably the most serious challenge that Tevye has confronted so far, and he reacts accordingly. In giving in to Hodel, he used the phrase, Kerachem ov al bonim, from the 103rd Psalm, as a father pities his children, so the Lord pities them that fear him. And his accommodating, milky nature is by now so well established that we really expect him to reconcile himself to another loss, and we wait to see how he's going to manage it this time. He is always torn between contradictory allegiances, and his submission to the previous challenges leads us to expect that he is also going to submit to Chava's decision. One early critic, Balmachshovis, wrote that actually Tevye is more a female type than a male, in the sense that he is so accommodating. We can't help thinking something like this every time Tevye reins in his feelings with the words, Tevye is not a woman. He is tender-hearted, temperamentally liberal, Moreover, as he says, this child had a special place in his heart. Maybe it had to do with, he says, maybe it had to do with her being a sickly child who came down with every illness in the book. Why, the times we sat up all night with her, trying to snatch her from the very jaws of death, watching her fight for her life like a trampled little bird. But if God only wills it, he can even resurrect you from the grave. And loy omos ki echye, if my number hasn't come up yet, there's no reason to say die. So the parent, terrified of losing a child, had put his trust in God, and his prayer was answered. But now it is he, Tevye, who must decide the fate of this child, the life or death decision of the 118th Psalm. Loy omos ki echye, I shall not die but live and declare the works of God. And this applies to him directly. Was it for this that I had been a good Jew all my life, had bled myself white and raised 7 daughters, for them to break away in the end like the leaves that fall from a tree and are carried off by the wind? Why, just think of it. Here a tree grows in the forest, and here along comes a woodsman with an axe and begins to hack off its branches one by one. What good is a tree without its branches? And if the hacking continues, what will be left of the man who trusted in the Lord? On the other hand, if God once spared his favorite child, who is he, her father, to declare this child dead to him? So Chava believes that love conquers all in marriage and beyond. After her conversion and her marriage to Chvedka, and after the family has sat Shiva for her, she tries to make it up with her father. She overtakes him on the road, and this is the same place on the road where his other daughters overtook him. And in that case, in those cases, he was lenient. So she tries to overtake him as well. And they launched their successful appeals. And she is at least as desperate as Tzeitl. She says, Papa, Papa, I beg you, at least listen to me. Tevye hears her pleas. He has even absorbed some of her argument that now comes to him in his own thoughts. What did being a Jew or not a Jew matter? Why did God have to create both? And if he did, why put such walls between them so that neither would look at the other even though both were his creatures? It grieved me that I was not a more learned man, because surely there were answers to be found in the holy books. The degree to which Tevye loves, respects, and sympathizes with his daughter prepares us for his capitulation. The person of faith is very often caricatured as a true believer, someone who has all the ready-made answers. But in this work, real faith is where the problems begin. Were Tevye the dry stereotype of Jewish Enlightenment fiction, he would have declared Chava dead, sat Shiva for her, and wiped his hands of her. For their part, the American secular interpreters of the Tevye story say, what's the big deal? A Ukrainian protector is an asset, not a liability. As we've seen, Tevye comes up with not a single philosophic, religious, or moral answer to these questions. He doesn't have the tools to find the answers. Sholem Aleichem puts every last weight on the side of leniency and no weight at all on the side of obduracy. And yet, Tevye resists Chava's entreaties. The story is a turning point, or as we might say, a tipping point, the point at which an object is no longer balanced, and adding a small amount of weight can cause it to topple. The Bible's template for this chapter may be Jeremiah chapter 17, verses 5 to 8, where the prophet relays God's view of Jewish survival. And I quote from there, "Thus saith the Lord, cursed is he who trusts in man, who makes mere flesh his strength, and turns his thoughts from the Lord. He shall be like a bush in the desert, which does not sense the coming of good. It is set in the scorched places of the wilderness, in a barren land without inhabitant. Blessed is he who trusts in the Lord, whose trust is in the Lord alone. He shall be like a tree planted by waters, sending forth its roots by a stream. It does not sense the coming of heat. Its leaves are ever fresh. It has no care in a year of drought. it does not cease to bear fruit, the tree to which Tevye refers. Now, Tevye does not have Jeremiah's assurance. He is the everyday Jew thousands of years after Jeremiah, by which time he is drawing on an interpretive tradition that has already argued through every phrase of the Bible. He's the modern Jew who has to make sense of his situation all on his own. He is that tree planted by the waters or standing in the forest, and he feels the branches being hacked off, the loss of the Chava branch being almost too much to bear. But if he models himself on God the Father who pities his children, he is also made in the image of God who commands the Jew to have no other gods before him. Though Tevye finds it easier to be the obedient Jew who just follows God's commands, he must also rise to the challenge of imposing his authority on his children. He has other children and grandchildren who will follow Chava's example unless they know that they must not. So, like it or not, Chava's actions implicitly would eventually eliminate Tevye, the tree, and the Jewish God who made him in his image. So if we want to know what resistance is, this is Jewish resistance. This is what it takes. Resistance to conversion and intermarriage is the irreducible requirement of the Jewish people in this work. Tevye is the covenantal Jew who wrestles with the very questions that Chava raises about whether being a Jew or not a Jew mattered, why God had to create both, why he put such walls between them. He lives the question rather than answering it, and this story will persuade us or it will not. We've been tracing the theme of communication, seeing how it declines between Seitel and Hodel. And now we come to the point where it cannot go any further at all. Tevye, the great speaker, chooses silence over speech, where speech has failed him and where speech can be of no benefit. He cannot be of benefit. He does not have the arguments. This is not a polemic that he can win, right? And Chava knows that if she can just get her father to talk to her, she will find a way to win him over. But Tevye shows a side of himself that we've not seen before. Oh-ho, I thought, so you think you can make me knuckle under? Whatever you call it, pride, national resolve, religious steadfastness, a show of masculinity, decisiveness, or hardness, it's a side of Tevye we hadn't seen before, and it was as untrendy then as it remains today. And in a sense, we know from this, and we know from the reaction of some of the young revolutionaries and modern young Jews of the time to this, that trendiness then as now is always on the side of less Jewish rather than more. So this story was written after Shalom Aleichem and his family had experienced the pogrom in Kiev that might have killed them, and when his hopeful spirit had taken something of a beating. One can almost hear the author's voice behind that of the character. Oh-ho, I thought, so you think you can make me knuckle under because I'm known to be a humorist who wants to bring comfort to his people by offering them a happy ending? Well, this is my version of a happy ending. For Tevye, for the Jews, and for me, the writer who needs the Jewish people to stay intact in the present and in the future. So, until here, the story of Chava.
You were explaining that there's no such thing as, at the time, there's no such thing as a civil marriage. Can you expand on, that could be confusing for a listener and viewer today.
Yes, indeed. I think that this is the one point that may be harder to understand when you read the story, and that is one has to keep in mind that the priest was also aligned with the Tsarist government. And that in a place where there is no civil marriage, in order for Chava to marry Chvedka, she would have to be converted in the church. And so what the priest does is take her into his home. He teaches her the catechism or as much of it that he has to. He keeps her away from her family. He does not allow any conversation between her and her father during the time that she is in his home until the point that she is converted and married. And so it's not just that she is attracted to someone else and marries someone else. It is that she converts to another religion in order to do so. And so Tevye is silent at the end because by that time she is a Christian and he has sat Shiva for her as religious, as practicing Jews were accustomed to doing and as some continue to do. She is lost to the Jewish people, literally lost to the Jewish people. And so if she is lost to the Jewish people, he has to recognize that. And so he does not speak to her. Mm. In this most unusual turn in the Tevye story so far, this supremely adaptable person, this supremely lenient father, this person who has given in to his other daughters, does not stop on the road for her and does not agree to speak to her in her new role as no longer a Jew.
And of course, this preoccupation with assimilation has a very ringing resonance in the history of the Jewish people, theologically, historically, culturally. It's a deeply rooted Jewish preoccupation. On the other hand, do you see it as something that other communities could recognize as a problem of their own?
Absolutely. In other words, this is also one of the most universal chapters of the Tevye stories, oddly enough. Even though it seems so specifically Jewish, I think that every ethnic group and every religious group that sees itself trying to preserve its identity within a larger framework will immediately recognize the similarities between Tevye the father and the father in my big fat Greek wedding, who reacts exactly the same way, who wants his daughter to marry another Greek and to raise their children in that tradition, and Indian movies that are made on the same theme, and so forth. So it's strange that the more Jewishly rooted this story is and invested it is, the more it is also a universal question.
So what would you say are the two or three defining things that we should take out of the story of Chava?
Well, the story of Chava turns Tevye in his own context into a more heroic figure and also into a more tragic figure. He is the one who uses this image of a tree in a forest. What happens when you hack off all its branches? What is a tree without its branches? And he feels that Chava is the most precious branch at this point. How can he live with that? Nonetheless, he feels that he has no choice but to treat this subject as seriously as it is, because what he knows is different from what Chava says to him. You see, she doesn't present this problem as her marrying a Christian or becoming a Christian. She uses the universalist argument, and she makes the argument on that ground. Look, what's the difference between Jews and Christians? What's the difference between one group of people and another? Why should we observe that? And the truth of the matter is that that's disingenuous. She may put it that way, but it is never the case that one is marrying into universalism. One is always marrying into a majority, right? In such a situation where a minority is trying to preserve its ethnicity, its religion, within a majority context, it's always a case of you're not just, you know, marrying into a nothingness. There is no such thing as a nothingness. So essentially, you are making a choice whether you admit it to yourself or not. And I think that is a very interesting thing for American viewers to think about. From the American adaptation of this story, you see something else emerging. Those who adapted this story for the screen and for the theater in Fiddler on the Roof turned this around. They make Tevye feel guilty for wanting to preserve his distinctiveness, and they equate wanting to preserve your distinctiveness with the Tsarist decree against you. And they say, are you going to be like them? You're not going to want to marry me? It's exactly like the Tsar, kicking you out of the country later on, or in this episode, it's exactly like the priest being against you, right? And they make an equivalence between these two things. This is really a dramatic step forward. And I don't think this is fair to the Tevye stories at all, or to any minority that wants to preserve its distinctiveness. The idea of wanting to remain distinct is not the same as a prejudice that wants you and forces you to be like itself. These are two opposites and not two equivalents.